closer up to your eyes and snudge, using the kind of language that makes the sergeant blush. Oh, who wouldn't join the army? That's what we all inquire. Don't we pity the poor civilian sitting around the fire? Oh, 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 it's a lovely war.
Oh, it's a lovely war.
Oh, who wouldn't be a soldier, eh?
Oh, it's a shame to take the pain.
As soon as Reveille is gone,
we feel just as heavy as lead.
But we never get up to the sergeant brings a breakfast up to bed. Oh, 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 it's a lovely war.
Oh,
what do we want? We need eggs and ham. When we got plum and apple jam. Home for the right turn. How do we spend the money we earn? Oh, 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 it's a lovely war. Oh, 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 it's a lovely war.
Oh, what a lovely war.
Oh, what will be a soldier, eh?
Oh, it's a shame to take the pay.
As soon as the valley is gone,
we feel just as heavy as lead.
But we never get up to the sergeant brings our breakfast up to bed.
What?
Oh, 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 it's a lovely war.
What a lovely war.
What do we want with eggs and ham when we got plum and apple jam? Home for the great car. We spend the money we earn. Oh, 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 it's a lovely war. Come to the cookhouse door, boys. Sniff at the lovely stew. Oh, as it says, the colonel gets better grub than you. Any complaints this morning? Do we complain, not we? What's the matter with lumps of onion floating around your tea? Oh, 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 it's a lovely war.
Oh, it's a lovely war.
Oh, oh, wouldn't be a soldier, eh?
Oh, it's a shame to take the pain.
As soon as the valley has gone, we feel just as heavy as lead. But we never get up to the sergeant brings our breakfast up to bed.
Rats.
Oh, 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 it's a lovely war.
It's a lovely war.
Who wasn't wanting eggs and ham when we got plum and apple jam? Home for the right turn. How do we spend the money we earn? Oh, 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 it's a lovely war. Oh, 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 it's a lovely war.
Oh, it's a lovely war.
Who wouldn't be a soldier, eh?
Oh, it's a shame to take the pay.
As soon as the valley has gone,
we feel just as heavy as lead.
But we never get up till the sergeant brings our breakfast up to bed.
Liar.
Oh, 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 it's a lovely war.
Oh,
we want with eggs and ham when we got plum and apple jam. Comfort, retard, how can we spend the money we earn? Oh, 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 it's a lovely war.
The First World War may have ended in 1918, but its repercussions are still felt today. Almost 100 years after the signing of the armistice, the Great War, as it's also known, is still talked about, commemorated and analysed around the world. But how exactly did the fighting in France and Belgium affect those in Britain, and, more specifically, in Cambridge? How did the people in this city, hundreds of miles away from trench warfare, experience the conflict? And when those who'd been fighting returned home, what did they tell their loved ones about the things they'd seen in battle? In this programme, the first of two, we'll look at the effects of the First World War on Cambridge. We'll hear personal testimonies from residents recalling the experiences of their parents and grandparents. We'll also talk to historians about the impact the war had on the city and its citizens, and how that impact is still evident today. But let's start by going back to that time before August 1914. In the months leading up to the official declaration of war, it was obvious on the ground that preparations were being made by those in power for something very serious, a fact that surprised local historian Mike Petty.
And again, one thing that I didn't properly appreciate until I was doing research was just how much preparation had taken place before the war started. There were so many army manoeuvres and mock attacks on places like Madingley and the hills around Bolsham. And, of course, you mustn't forget those great army manoeuvres of 1912. Because in 1912, an enemy army landed on the east coast and headed inland. And we'd needed to raise an army to stop them. And each army had aeroplanes, and each army had airships, and each army had horses, and each army had bicycles. And those two armies clashed around Bolsham and Linton. The King of England came to Trinity. He stayed in Trinity and went off to inspect his troops. He changed to a horse and went into the village of Horse Heath, where he watched the battle that was literally raging from gravestone to gravestone. Farm workers were amazed that their king was in their presence. They didn't know whether to look at the fighting or to look at him. It was, of course, just an exercise. An exercise to test if we could have stopped them. An exercise that had been planned by Sir John French at Trinity College in 1908. And it was an exercise that showed we could not stop them. So that when we go to war and the Germans are pushing through and they're heading to the Belgian coast, the fear is that that exercise will too quickly actually happen. That an enemy army will land on the east coast. Which is why we mobilise a defence force. Which is why soldiers, proper trained soldiers, are in Cambridge, where East Anglia will be the front line if that invasion comes. But of course the invasion never came. It was halted by that contemptible little army, and the pressure passed, and we've forgotten that it ever existed. But at the start of the war, it was real.
But the two leaders who were to face one another across the battlefield hadn't always been such enemies. The family of the late Brian Harris lived and worked in Cambridge. His parents ran a shop and cafe on Hills Road. Brian recalls the time his mother looked out of the shop window and saw two very special passers-by.
But she remembers George V and his cousin, Kaiser Bill, passing their shop at Hills Road on horseback on their way to the Gog Magog Hills, probably still known as the Gogs, to watch manoeuvres. I mean, how ridiculous is that? So just a few years, I don't know how many years, but not many, before the First World War, and there are the two future enemies walking down Hills Road. And I think there is a picture somewhere in the archives of them passing Christ's College. They probably stayed at Trinity College, I don't know. But this, you know, the Hills Road is the old Via Divana, the Roman road going from Huntingdon out to the east. But there we are. That archive is somewhere. And it was a very historic event for her to witness.
By the middle of 1914, it was clear to most people that some sort of conflict was inevitable. And wars need soldiers to fight them. Mike Petty again.
So the Cambridge papers published an account of what was happening in Belgium. Well, in Belgium there was a little city called Louvain, and Louvain was sacked by the Germans. And Louvain was their equivalent of Cambridge. So they made the point, if what happened in Louvain happened here, then King's College Chapel would be set on fire, that there would be shells raking along the backs, that professors and ministers of religions and editors of newspapers would be lined up in the marketplace and shot. Which, of course, encouraged the editors of newspapers to encourage people to join up. And Cambridge lads, university lads, responded to the call. And they emptied the colleges. But you can't have empty colleges, not in a place like Cambridge, which is an education factory. So we fill up the colleges with other lads, soldiers, officer cadets. Cambridge colleges open their doors to these people that are being taught not Latin and Greek, but bombing and shelling. We're having manoeuvres on the Gogs with the digging of trenches. Later we are to have tank battles on the Gogs. And colleges are not only taking these lads, but they're training their lads to be soldiers. But the colleges are also training the lads to be gentlemen. Because, of course, you must be an officer and a gentlemen. With the outbreak of the war, then there is an appeal for people to come forward and join, and people respond to that call. And initially, those Cambridge men who were already in the army were called away early in the first group.
Cambridgeshire Chronicle, August 1914. There was a large attendance at a meeting held in the Trumpington Reading Rooms on Monday evening, convened for the purpose of obtaining recruits from the district for the Second Army. Mr. J. Vinter presided and explained that all young fellows between the ages of 19 and 30 years had been specially invited to the meeting. The parish of Trumpington had a population of about 720, and he found that among this population there were some 68 or 70 who were between the age limits. He did not suppose it would be possible for all the 70 to join Lord Kitchener's army, but he ventured to suggest that all unmarried men should feel their country had a first claim on them. He was afraid that this was not going to be a short war, and it might only be a short time before every young man had to be called up. He trusted that all those who could see their way would at once enlist in His Majesty's service. They were out to win, but they could not win unless they sent out men. Major John Morley said they wanted to show that every man in this country was prepared to do his part. He was sure some of them wished they were younger. He had one son fighting in France with the expeditionary force, and had he a dozen sons, he would wish them all to be there. He hoped there would be a hearty response from the very stalwart Englishmen who were present at the meeting that evening.
Michael Bowyer's grandfather, Henry Bowyer, was one of five brothers who fought in the war, four of whom returned. Michael has spent a lot of time researching his family history. Speaking on the telephone, he tells of how his grandfather and great-uncles came to enlist and fight.
Now, many of them had in fact been volunteers, or territorials as we call them now. They were army volunteers, and this was something which they'd obviously done of their own volition. And if we look at John, who's the second eldest, he was a bricklayer, and then he became a motorcycle mechanic in his spare time. And when he joined up in 1915, he'd already served 6 years in the 2nd Volunteer Battalion of the Essex Regiment. He did live in Kent. Sorry, he did live in Cambridge, but this was a unit which was on the Essex-Cambridgeshire border. And that's how he got involved. And he, at the time, was living at 206 Cherry Hinton Road. And he was already married and had 6 children when he went to war. And he served in the Army Service Corps, which is the motor transport department of the Army. And he went to Flanders in 1916 with the British Expeditionary Force in their signals unit, 35th Signals GRE unit.
Another Cambridge resident, Henry Marshall, also remembers his grandfather, Arthur Marshall, telling him about joining up.
He was walking over Mill Road Bridge and bumped into some of his friends, and they told him that they were going to the recruiting office. So he thought, oh, that might be fun, and went along with them to the recruiting office. Well, the recruiting people, the army recruiting people, were not interested in the friends, but they wanted grandfather. So he enlisted, and these friends just then disappeared. So grandfather was in the army. Now, that wasn't perhaps too surprising, because his older brother, also Henry Marshall, was already in the army. He was in the artillery. So grandfather enlisted and went as a volunteer, and it was before the territorial started, so I can't remember what that was called. Written in my notes. But anyway, he went off and was trained over in Suffolk.
Cambridgeshire Chronicle, August 1914. The message, which had hourly been expected, ordering the departure of the Cambridge Territorials, arrived on Friday night, and Saturday morning saw the departure of the men to take up duty at the place assigned to them. The different companies assembled at their various centres and marched to the rendezvous at Parker's Peace. From here, headed by the regimental band, they marched to the station. Crowds of townspeople lined the streets and accompanied the territorials as the drum and fife band played Auld Lang Syne and God Save the King. Outside the station, despite the rain, a dense crowd of townspeople had assembled to bid them adieu. Loud were the cheers which ascended as the train bearing Cambridge's soldier sons steamed out of the station. The men leaned out of the carriage windows to echo back the cheers to those gathered there.
It's estimated that 2 years into the war, more than 4,000 men from in and around Cambridge had enlisted to fight. But with the rate of attrition and mortality higher than expected on the battlefield, more men were needed. And in 1916, the government took action. Mike Petty.
Conscription comes in because we weren't encouraging enough people to join up. Now, when it initially comes, I mean, when conscription originally comes, papers are advertising the names of the men who are going out from many of the Cambridge industries. And many of the Cambridge industries do send men. I mean, the Cambridge University Press sends hundreds of men, and after the war's over, it publishes a book that lists the names of those men. But we can't get enough men. And if we can't appeal to them to join up, then we need the scription, conscription. You will go. And then the Cambridge papers are full of accounts of the appeal tribunals. These people whose employers are saying, we need this man here now. We have so much to do. We have to supply so many horseshoes for military horses. We can't lose blacksmiths. We need so many people to run the Cambridge institutions, the Cambridge departments, the Cambridge shops. And paper, page after page after page of the Cambridge Daily News is full of the list of these people who are begging to be allowed to keep men back. And, of course, it's not just employers that are begging. Mothers are begging and fathers are begging. In our village at Streatham, Mrs. Swan from the village post office went to the military tribunal. Already one of her sons had enlisted. She needed the other two to help her run the village post office. The gentleman sitting in judgment said, "No, missus, you can't keep them both. You decide which one goes." And then you get the people who really have a conscientious objection to fighting. And their story also is one that tends not to be told.
What I am, I will explain to you. My conscience is the only thing that helps to pull me through. Objection is a thing that I have studied thoroughly. I don't object to fighting Huns, but should hate them fighting me. Non-combatant battalions are fairly in my line, but the sergeant always hates me, and he calls me baby nine. But oh, I got so cross with him, I rose to the attack, and when he called me Ethel, I just called him this as that. Send out the army and the navy, send out the rank and file, send out the brave old territorial, they'll face the danger with a smile. Send out the boys of the old brigade who made old England free. Send out me brother, me sister and me mother, but for God's sake don't send me. We have a nasty officer, he is a horrid brute. Last Friday he was terse with me, 'cause I did not salute. But I cut him twice today, and then he asked the reason, see. I said I thought, dear Captain, that you still were cross with me. Send out the army and the navy, send out the rank and file, send out the brave old territorial, they'll face the danger with a smile. Send out the boys of the old brigade who made old England free.
out the bakers and the blooming profit makers, but for God's sake, don't send me.
Cambridgeshire Chronicle, August 1916. Two claims made on the grounds of the applicant's conscientious objection came before the Cambridge Tribunal at their sitting yesterday, when some pointed remarks were made by the chairman for the day, Alderman H.M. Taylor. Dr. James Crowther of Defreville Avenue claimed exemption on the ground of his conscientious scruples. His occupation was put down as Doctor of Science, Examiner and Inspector. It was his absolute and conscientious conviction that war was contrary to the spirit and letter of the law of love laid down by Christ. As his dedicated servant, he could not therefore take any part, either combatant or non-combatant, nor could he accept any service in any branch of His Majesty's forces, holding that the military oath demanded an implicit obedience which was due to God alone. The chairman said the tribunal was very adverse to leaving men who refused to help their country in the present state of war in comfortable civil positions, drawing their emoluments, while their fellow countrymen were risking lives and limbs in the trenches. They thought such persons should not be allowed to receive more than they would receive if called to the colours. The claim was adjourned to suggest work of national importance which he would be willing to undertake.
Brian Harris's family were staunch Plymouth Brethren, a religious sect that had a strong presence in certain parts of the city. Many lived in the neighbourhood of Cherry Hinton Road, known at the time as Cherry Hinton Farm, turning it into a temperance area, a fact incidentally reflected in the relatively few number of pubs in that region of Cambridge, even today. And as well as being teetotal, Plymouth Brethren members were not expected to fight.
So my parents were Plymouth Brethren, and a very narrow sect known as Exclusive Brethren. And they not only followed what they thought were the principles of the New Testament of the Bible, but they withdrew from the world rather than participate in it. They withdrew. And in 1916, the loss of life at the front was so great and far more than ever anticipated, that they were running short of men. And for the first time ever, first time in history, apart from press gangs, they brought in conscription. So, Plymouth Brethren, what was their attitude to that? I don't think it was a requirement, but I think it was a stated expectation that you would want to be exempt from military service. So, the deadline was 12 o'clock on a Saturday. The Corn Exchange in Cambridge became a recruiting office, and my father, Plymouth Brother, his future brother-in-law, Plymouth Brother, and somebody called Walter Freeman, who lived in Hope Street, just off Mill Road. They were all called to attest, was the word. And they walked up and down the Corn Exchange Street, pondering, should they or should they not? If they didn't go in by 12 o'clock and attest, what would happen? They could be imprisoned, they could be shot. Nobody knew. So my father, Walter Harris, and his future brother-in-law, Harold Drake, decided not to go in, and Walter Freeman did. So, my uncle was sent to Salisbury Plain, where he worked with soldiers preparing for the front, because the government had brought in a conscience clause whereby if you refused to fight or had a conscientious objection to fighting, you went to a tribunal. And if you satisfied the judges that you were genuine, you were declared exempt from military service. So my uncle goes to Salisbury Plain. My father, and this is ridiculous, my father, who'd been a cadet in the Red Cross, was sent to a mill where there were another group of the Plymouth Brethren. And the miller had three sons, and his three sons, who were also got Jesuits, as far as I know, joined the Royal Army Medical Corps as orderlies at the front. So my father worked on this mill for 2 years, and when the sons came home, my father had the good grace to cycle home. So I never knew quite how he felt about that, with these chaps, you know, who'd gone to the front, and he'd had a cushy number running the mill.
But conscientious objection didn't come without a price. As well as musical criticism, conscientious objectors, or conscies, as they were sometimes called, often experienced outright hostility. Brian Harris again.
My father talked endlessly about his conscience and the way he searched his conscience up and down Corn Exchange Street. And I often wondered, why was he doing this? Why at Sunday tea was he always telling our visitors? Was he doubtful? But then the Second World War came, and he was called up for the Home Guard. He objected on religious grounds, and he was exempt. That was amazing. Call you out in the street. How are you doing, Conchi? And when he went to his tribunal, I was declared exempt from the Home Guard in the Second World War. All the shopkeepers, apparently the shopkeepers in our row from Mawson Road to Tennyson Road, sent him a telegram. Congratulations, Conchie. Exclamation mark. So he suffered a lot of persecution. And it was very upsetting for all of us.
Nationally, it's estimated that one in four men went to fight in Europe, either voluntarily or through conscription. And with a quarter of the male population away from home, it was women who literally stepped up to the plate to keep the trade and industry of the country functioning. From 1914 and throughout the war years, the women of Britain worked harder and longer. Deborah Tom is a lecturer at Robinson College, Cambridge.
Well, a lot of women carried on doing what they'd done before, but did more of it, particularly women who worked in agriculture, on farms, dairies, small holdings, allotments, women who worked in shops. They often took over the family business and carried it on while their menfolk were away. And you see in farming, for example, a lot of women running the farms themselves and finding it very valuable. And we forget how rural Cambridge was in the First World War. There were lots of people whose whole livelihood was based on farming. So at the beginning of the war, there's not much impact for the women, but gradually the men start going away and the women start taking over. And then they do jobs they haven't done before, like looking after the cattle. And they go back to old things like being dairy maids, which they'd done in the 19th century. And they take up new jobs in the town. So they start being typists and clerks and doing more in shop work. They go into schools in a limited way in Cambridge. There's not that much replacement of teachers by women. A lot of employers are very reluctant to take on women, and there's examples in the newspapers of employers saying, oh, we can't possibly have women. There was a garage down Cherry Hinton Road, and they said, we can't have women working with cars. They did end up having one at the end of the war. But mostly it was jobs like what women had done before, and it was white-collar jobs in shops and offices. There are some women that volunteer for war work and leave Cambridge and go and work in factories. There's a few small factories in Cambridge, and there are some women doing very heavy manual jobs, like the women who worked on the gasworks, shovelling coke, and there are pictures of them wearing, unusually for the day, wearing trousers or leggings with dirty faces and their hair tied back. That was very hard work. And they went into that because there was no one else to do it, and some of them were young and strong. What you don't get in Cambridge are things that you get elsewhere, women being navvies or hauling beer barrels. Cambridge remained quite isolated from the war in some ways. You don't get big factories set up near here. It's quite a small market town, really. And, of course, in the university, you still have loads of women doing domestic service jobs, looking after the very small number of students, and you get women, of course, being nurses during the war.
Cambridge resident Janet Slade's mother was a nurse, and Janet herself recalls seeing many women working as she grew up, particularly in teaching.
When I was a little girl, every teacher was a single woman. I remember talking to the head years after about a very bitter teacher. And I said, I understand that they didn't have husbands. She said, it wasn't they didn't have husbands, Janet. There was no other work, and if you hated teaching, it was a pure agonised punishment from one day's end to the other.
One was a very good teacher, but she had her favourites. And the other, she was in the top class, and you were made to dread Miss Chapman. But I liked her. I was not a great student. I was always held up by my inability to do maths. But she understood that, and she was somebody who would look for the things you were good at. And all my life I've written doggerel for leaving parties, wedding anniversaries, the lot. And she once said, rhyming will get you nowhere, boy. And I always quote that because actually it has. very useful when you were working, and leaving parties bonded you with the people you were working with, and I usually come out with a moment. I mean, perhaps it was good that she did say that, because it was a challenge. If she told you that it was no good, you would immediately go on the other foot and make jolly sure that it did do some good.
But maybe these memories of bitter and unpleasant female teachers don't tell the whole story. Deborah Tom.
I wonder how much that's to do with the war. We get lots of accounts in oral history of teachers who don't really like children or teaching, but they've ended up doing that because it's something you do when you've got an education. But that bitterness might have come from a sense that they're dealing with children in larger numbers than they would have before. They're not very well supported. Again, it's hard work. And a lot of children are very distressed in wartime and quite difficult to handle. We find some incidents of children being a bit out of control. And again, it's often attributed entirely to the war, and it may not necessarily be. I wonder also how many of them are talking about the same woman who behaves in this unpleasant way. I just don't know. Certainly, literature after the war seems to show some women feeling that they've landed up in this job and then they just get on with it. They have to pay off loans. They may be supporting families. And schools were, you know, full of children, some of whom didn't want to be there either. And a lot of teachers were, as we know from autobiography and so on, a lot of them were not very exciting lessons that children had to do.
Yeah.
Cambridgeshire Chronicle, July 1916. The Cambridge Borough Tribunal and the Cambridge County Appeal Tribunal appear to be doing their work to a manner which should be an example to others. They realise that every interest has to be second to the imperative necessity of winning the war, and that if for the winning of the war practically every able-bodied man in the country has to be taken from his occupation, it has got to be done, no matter how great the personal and financial inconvenience, for if we lose the war, we have lost everything. The last sittings of the aforementioned tribunals were remarkable for the few, the very few, exemptions allowed, and if every tribunal did its duty as conscientiously as these two are doing theirs, the scandals of which we have heard so much of late would soon be a thing of the past. Equity would prevail, and the army would get the men it wants, the young, vigorous men, rather than the inferior substitutes it has to take.
And while the boys were away, the growing suffrage movement, alongside the continuing social changes, were giving women more power and more choices.
There are a few that embrace new opportunities really strongly and see it as a chance to show what women can do. You've got strong suffrage movement in Cambridge, women fighting for the vote. You've got both the militant Women's Social and Political Union and the more conventional and bigger National Union and Women's Suffrage Societies. And they see the war as a place where women can demonstrate their capabilities.
But while women may have had more power in the workplace, they still couldn't vote. In fact, universal suffrage was not granted until 1928. Until then, women kept campaigning and being punished for that campaigning. Janet Slade remembers her mother's opinion on the mistreatment of suffragettes.
She just said how absolutely shocking it was the way they treated the women who they took in and force-fed them. She was absolutely horrified at that. You know, her condemnation for those for the insensitivity and the hardness and the blindness. She was absolutely horrified at that.
Cambridgeshire Chronicle, May 1914. The committee of the Cambridge Women's Suffrage Association were at home at the Lion Hotel on Saturday. Miss Montgomery said that it seemed to her that in the country it was claimed that the government was representative, and ever since she had been old enough to think at all on that subject, she had felt very strongly that the claim of representative government was founded on a half-truth. No government could claim to be a righteous government if it were founded on a half-truth, and therefore she had no doubt on the question of women's suffrage. Professor Chapman said the number of people who considered that, for fundamental reasons, women ought not to have the vote was very few, but there was a large number of people who thought that the question did not matter. He said he believed that if women were given the vote, it would have a large and important influence on the social conditions of the country.
Support for the suffrage movement remains quite strong among the constitutional suffragists. After all, their leader, Millicent Garrett Fawcett, lived here for a while before the war. Her husband was professor of political economy. Her daughter was an outstanding mathematician. And their organisation contributes women who are very important in the town, like Mrs. Keynes, the mother of the economist John Maynard Keynes, who holds almost every office on the city council at some time or another, starts her career there in the war. So that sense of responsibility of making a contribution to town life is really important. But, you know, these women knew that they could do that already. They didn't get that from the war, and they were trying to do it before the war and getting somewhere in local government. There's a lot of women very active in local government. The militant suffragettes, the Women's Social and Political Union, switched entirely from being against the government to being in its favour, and they would recruit troops, speak on recruiting platforms and urge people on to make more and more effort to support the war. And they end the war standing for election, not winning seats, and become, most of them, conservatives, like Emmeline and Christabel Pankhurst. In Cambridge, they've not been that strong, and they kind of aren't much seen during the war years. But the idea that the vote is worth having is, I think, myself, that it had already been recognised before the war, and in a way the war almost delays it. And the political parties realise in December 1916, when they discuss what they're going to do after the war, that they've got to include the women, otherwise they'll get militancy reviving. And they give women the vote precisely calculated so that there won't be a majority of women voters. And they say it's because women over 30 will be more mature, but in fact, it seems quite cynical to me. In 10 years later, all women get the vote the same as men. So if you see nationally, one in three women having the vote compared to 7 out of 10 men. So it's, to some women, the vote seems absolutely, they're ready for it and it's important to them and they make use of it and participate, but it's not so central to their ideas about what they do. So what most women political activists turn their attention to are things like health and welfare, particularly of children. Some, the more left-wing ones, get involved in trade unionism. So their new vote goes towards the new young Labour Party. Others are very active in liberalism. Cambridge, like everywhere, sees women doing politics in lots of different ways.
The war years were also a time during which views on a range of subjects began to change. Love, sex and marriage, for example.
There is, to some extent, a bit of a loosening of morality during the First World War. It's not very noticeable in Cambridge. There are a few cases of women hauled up for prostitution, but most of them appear to have travelled to practice their trade. Cambridge is not, doesn't have very many young men in it to be their clients. And after the first year of war, when there are lots of soldiers around, passing through to training camps, camping on Jesus Green and Midsummer Common, there are fewer soldiers around, so prostitution isn't a very valuable trade. There are women prosecuted for selling drinks out of hours to soldiers and gambling with them and misbehaving. There are a few women who are effectively divorced under the existing legislation. It's not quite divorced, but separated legally from their husbands because they've been misbehaving with soldiers. So it's very anecdotal evidence. The general impression is that most people are too busy, too tired, too hungry to be going in for much frivolity. But there is a slight loosening of conventional restraints. Students, for example, don't have to be chaperoned in wartime, which they used to be before the war. There's very popular cinemas in Cambridge, extremely enthusiastically, and seen as a little bit haunts of vice. But because the drink trade is controlled by legislation after 1915, there's less drinking, probably, and to some extent less drunkenness. So it's a very mixed picture. And people's devotion to marriage as an idea and yearning for marriage remains terribly strong. And we can see that in the postcards soldiers send and things like that. And the popular poetry you get in the newspapers, which looks quite sentimental to us now, but I suppose is a bit like pop songs. There are popular songs as well. So there's, if you look at the cinema, the films that they're showing are often very romantic and very much ending in marriage or a kiss or something like that.
And this change of opinion extended to not just what we would call today sex workers, but to French sex workers. Janet Slade.
My mother talked about the prostitutes who were employed by the French government in the First World War to keep up men's morale. And she said, you may hear talk about prostitutes, Jan, because I was only about 12, 13, she said, don't you ever, ever condemn them. You don't know what they do for men who will never have the money or the opportunity to feel the love of a woman's arms. You never condemn a prostitute. Some of them are very brave women, and you are to respect that. How many mothers would say that to a child? And then I saw photographs of the First World War. It was in Picture Post, this extraordinary, you know, photograph magazine during the war, during the peace, of a caravan and all the girls posing there. And they were used to keep up the men's morale.
In the second programme of this two-part series, there'll be more memories of life in Cambridge during the First World War, and we'll also take a look at the conflict itself, the conditions in the trenches, the treatment of injured men both overseas and at home, and life in the depression that followed. We'll hear from Roger Lilly on the importance of postcards sent to and from the front, and Mike Petty will talk about how men dealt with their memories once they'd returned. So I'm with Claire Adler. We're sitting in the community room at Rock Road Library. We've got this wonderful exhibition on the wall opposite us. Tell us about the exhibition, Claire.
The exhibition is about World War One in our local area around Rock Road Library. So it's a part of a two-year project. We had one exhibition last year, which was looking at who... Well, we researched and found out who lived around this area and who was involved in the First World War in the military. So that was last year's exhibition. This year, we've been trained some volunteers to do oral histories, and we've used the oral histories to actually pinpoint four families who lived in the area and found out about their family lives during the First World War, because obviously they themselves didn't know because they're too old. And then, so there's that part. And then there's another part. Researchers have been looking into all the shops that were on Cherry Hinton Road during the First World War. So we've also pinpointed a number of different shops that you could, that were about in the First World War on Cherry Hinton Road. That's a rubbish sentence. And it looks in more depth at that, particularly things like the laundries as well. There are so many laundries on Cherry Hinton Road, which I never knew about before.
So the exhibition is a mixture of archive research and quotes from the oral histories.
Yeah, it is. It's a mixture of research that volunteers have done into the local area, and then the oral histories that people recorded and then transcribed, so that we've now got elements of it that are written.
And why do you think it's important to have an exhibition like this?
It's important, particularly in Cambridge, because people move. Cambridge isn't a place where people live here forever. We found that out by doing this research, quite how many families move in and out of the area. So giving yourself a sense of place by understanding who lived in your house before you helps you understand where you fit into the larger history of the city. One of the things we've found out is that people who did live here have moved out, but also there are some families that do still remember some of the families that are illustrated in the exhibition. So things like Brian Harris's family, who are Plymouth Brethren, Brenda Perkis, who's also on the committee for the Friends, she remembers the larger family from it. So it's helped ignite other memories by people.
And it explains why some things are as they are today.
It does explain why some things are today. It particularly explains why there are so few pubs in this area. The Plymouth Brethren were a dry society, and they... As a result, that is why there is only the Rock Pub, which is a later pub anyway. But compared to Mill Road, there are so few pubs here, and that is exactly why.
And this is supported by the Heritage Lottery Fund.
Yeah, the Heritage Lottery Fund gave us a grant to do this whole project, because this exhibition is just one part element of it. There was, as I said, the exhibition last year, and there will be another one next year as well, which will probably be about the hospitals that are in the area, because there are a number of hospitals around Rock Road in the First World War.
So this exhibition will stay up until...
This exhibition will stay up till this time next year, when again it will change into something else. I don't know what it's going to look like yet, but we will do the research and find out.